There's a genre of TV shows that almost as soon as TVs became popular in households in America, these shows also became very popular. And if you are to think in your mind about some of the first shows, I didn't see them back in the 50s, but some of you may have, but there were new shows and sitcoms with Father Knows Best and that type of show, and then there were variety shows. But almost as soon as TVs became popular in people's homes, these shows became popular. And for decades, these type of shows were known as the money-making or the richest type of genre for TV shows, because they didn't cost as much to produce, and yet they were very popular, and so advertisers would pay top dollar to advertise during soap operas. So that's the genre that starting in the 50s, became extremely popular. From the 70s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, they were the leading shows on TV for money-making. So the advertisers would pay top dollars to advertise during those. And if you, any of you have seen a daytime soap opera, there's nighttime soap operas as well. Some of you might remember Dallas and Who Shot J.R. It seemed as if some time ago, I don't remember exactly when that was. I wasn't a fan of Dallas myself, but I do remember how important it was for people to find out who shot J.R. Some of you might remember that. That was a nighttime soap opera. But during the daytime, there's an emphasis on the open narratives or the storylines that continue from one show to another. And they tend to focus on families, extended families, and the interaction and the family drama that happens between the people. There's the emotional and moral conflicts that take place and difficult family interconnections, jealousies, sexual drama, envies, intrigue, murder, all kinds of things that take place during these soap operas. And for many years, people would plan their lives around the time of their favorite soap opera. I can remember that for a number of years in our household, I would come home from high school. I must have been about a freshman in high school, I think. And there was a soap opera on the TV in our house. And it was General Hospital. And I would come home and get a snack and plop in front of the TV. And I found myself wanting to get home from high school to find out what was going to happen next with Luke and Laura, because they were supposed to get married. And when they were there at their wedding at the altar, one of them got kidnapped. And then who knew what was going to happen? So there was all this intrigue taking place, and people get so involved in the fictional characters, and some people even wonder, why isn't my life that exciting or that full of emotion and drama? Today, of course, that genre has switched somewhat. Instead of the beautiful actors and actresses who play out these various confusing and complicated lives that they tend to live in soap operas, today we have reality TV. So more average people can put themselves in a situation of being somehow in this type of intrigue and drama. So we have things like The Bachelorette or The Bachelor, a couple of series again that I always feel the obligation to make the point, I don't watch these shows. I know I watch enough TV to know what's on there. But we have this reality TV and the average person putting themselves in these situations. Or we follow people like Snooki and all the people on that show. So, again, more TV viewers are able to put themselves in that place as they go through drama. And they live vicariously through people who have these over-the-top emotions and things going on into their lives. So these types of emotional-driven dramas play out all around the world. Soap operas and various reality TV shows, they're in all languages. I say that as a generality. I can't guarantee they're in all languages, but where there are TV channels, these things take place. I have traveled enough around the world to have seen them in various languages, and various countries. Recently, in a very popular Taiwanese soap opera, one of the male lead characters had a mistress in the show. And this relationship on TV was said to make it very popular for young ladies to become mistresses in real life. There were so many people in the country that were caught up in the soap opera, and they glamorized this mistress and what this man was buying for her and doing for her and different things as they went through the various shows. Well, later on, various episodes took place, and I don't know if it was in the same season or the next season, the man's family fell apart because he had a mistress. And then all of a sudden they started recognizing, well, that's what happens in real life when people are doing that. And they never had terms like homewreckers before. And then they started talking about homewreckers and people causing difficulties with the family. And in the soap opera, when the affair ended and destroyed the marriage, homewrecking became a national topic to the point that when they had their country's beauty contest, the Miss Universe pageant, they actually made the contestants sign an agreement that they would not become a mistress. And they had to actually do public relations about why it wasn't a good idea to become a mistress. People become addicted to the drama and to the emotions and to the things that are taking place in these type of shows. And human beings throughout history have even applied these types of intrigue and drama and emotions to their deities or to their god. If you've read anything very much at all, I should say, about Greek mythology, then you know that the Greek gods played out very much like a modern-day soap opera as far as kidnappings and murders and jealousies and envies and all these things taking place. Not just the Greek gods. Romans did the same thing. They took a lot of the Greek gods, changed the names, but they still had very similar storylines with all this drama and type of things going on. So it's very common in religions where deities are given the same human attributes that lead to the same interactions and interconnectivity of character or characters in drama as a modern day soap opera. I'm just going to give you one example. We could go through the Greek mythology or Roman mythology, but I'm actually going to go into Hindu mythology. The Hindus, if any of you have seen a Hindu temple, they oftentimes will have a variety of their deities carved on the outside, usually around the top of one of their temples. And you can see the various deities that they have. They have thousands of them. And they are very much interconnected as family and very much interconnected in drama. So one of their deities is called Ganesh. It's G-A-N-E-S-H, E-S-H-A. And is considered the god of wisdom, prudence, and learning. He is said to be the remover of obstacles and the leader of the troops of inferior deities. He's the son of Shiva and Parvati, or of the scuff of Parvati's body. I'm not sure what that means exactly. I didn't research it enough to figure out what it is, but apparently I wouldn't want to be known as the scuff of someone's body, but that's what this deity is considered. He's worshipped in various shrines, and he's represented as a pot-bellied fat man of red or yellow color with four hands and a one-tusked elephant head. So if any of you have seen this before, that's what this deity is. It's the one with the four arms and hands and the elephant head, and the elephant head has one tusk. Now, this is the reason why I'm telling you about this. It's because there are many myths about what account for his head, but according to one, his father, Shiva, struck off his head when his son refused him entrance into his mother's bedroom. So he refused him entrance in there, stopped him from going in there for whatever be the reason, and the father cuts off the son's head. this is the deity. So to placate his wife comes out and says, "Hey, you chopped the head off my son. What are you doing?" And so to placate his wife, he replaced it with the head of an elephant. In another myth, the proud mother showed him off to Shiva. Now remember, Shiva is one of the higher deities and also considered to be the father of this deity. So the proud mother showed him off to Shiva, whose glance burned the child's head to ashes. And another deity, Brahma, advised Shiva to replace it with the first head they could find, and it happened to be that of an elephant. And so that's why he has an elephant's head. The lost tusk is explained in various legends, but when Rama, the seventh avatar of Vishnu, went to visit the sleeping Shiva, he was denied access by this Ganesh, and Rama threw his axe at him, and he turned just in time just to lose one of the tusks. But these are the deities of this religion, and if you go through the various ones, I'm not making fun of just this one religion, so understand what I'm doing. Because what I'm talking about is the fact that human beings attribute human nature to their gods and to gods. So we see, even in this description, anger, jealousy, envy, drama, all these things taking place and going on. So my question for you today and for me is, do we ever attribute human characteristics to God? Do you or I contribute human characteristics to our God, to the true God? So I don't think that we would do that to the extent of the drama of a soap opera. But I do it to make the point. Human nature leads to think of even deities or God in the same way that human beings are, and to operate the same way that human beings operate. And it's something that we should be aware of, because it's very easy to do. We're still human beings. Human life is going on all around us. And what we think of is physical. There is a word for it. I used the word anthropomorphism. I don't remember if it was last week or the week before, about where you human beings give animals human characteristics. There's a word that is theanthropism, which is just taking the Greek words God, Theo, and Anthro for man, and attributing human character or characteristics to God. And it is a technical term in theological circles, because the doctrine of Christ being both divine and human. But I'm not wanting to focus on that term. My focus is on bringing God down to our level in our minds. Bringing God down to a human level in our minds. And it's something that we have to guard against. So I'm going to give you, during the rest of the time of the split sermon, the spiritual principle, and challenge you to study it, to meditate, to pray about it, and strive to recognize whether or not you do this in your life, in your relationship with God. And because it is something that we have to guard against. Most of us have lived long enough by this point in time in our life that we've realized that it's not easy to bring other people up to God's standards. So those of you who go to school or work, striving to live according to God's way of life, especially when God's Spirit's not involved. There are people who choose to do good things. We understand that. But it's difficult to bring people up to God's standards. When there's things going on around us in this world, though, it's easy, if Christians are not on constant guard, to be brought down to the standards of the world. There is a certain aspect of human nature that tends to want to bring others down. Now, I'm speaking in a generality, but there is an aspect of human nature that wants to bring others down. So if somebody has poor character, they want others around them to have poor character. Otherwise, they might recognize they have poor character. They might recognize that what they're doing, or they might be told that what they're doing, is not good or right. And there's even a verse in the Bible that warns about it, that bad character will ruin, or it says bad company will ruin good character. So it's difficult to bring people up to God's standards. So we have to constantly constantly fight against or guard against being brought down to human nature or to human standards. Our challenge is to be spiritually minded. Like we heard in the first message, to stay spiritually minded. And it's a challenge that we view God constantly in a spiritual way. So the instant that we, in our minds, none of us can do this, actually. We understand that, and I'm not saying that we can. But the instant that in our minds we bring God down to a human level, we limit what He can do in our lives. So the instant any of us bring God down in our minds to a human level, we limit what God can do in our lives. It's important to think of it or consider it this way. If any of us put our faith in a human being, if any of us seek our happiness strictly from another human being, we will eventually be let down. Sooner or later, another human being, in one way or another, will let us down. So if we view God and God's motivations in the same way, we can easily begin to think that God has let us down. Or we could begin to wonder. It causes doubt. And it can cause cracks in our faith. So anytime in our minds that we begin to bring God down to a human level, it can easily lead to doubt and cause cracks in our faith. Mr. Jackson talked about God is love. Everything God does is motivated by love. Now, none of us should have any doubts about that. It's very clear from Scripture. So God is love. Everything that God does is based on His love. All of His motivations are based on godly love. Now, human beings tend to love in a selfish way. It starts off in a selfish way. We talk often about the strong love that mothers have for their children. Even that can be a selfish love. Well, God's love is always outward. It's always thinking of others. It's not a love to get or in any way a selfish love. So people will ask the question, if God is so loving, why is there so much suffering in the world? So have you ever brought it into your mind where you're thinking, if God is so loving, why am I dealing with this? Why am I going through this? Why do I still have this trial? Why do I have this pain? Whatever it might be. But if God is so loving, why is there so much suffering in the world? Why have so many people suffered? Or if I were God, and hopefully none of us have ever thought that, but if I were God, I wouldn't let this happen, or I would change this. Because the reality is, none of us as human beings can be more loving than God. Don't ever lose sight of that. None of us can be more loving than God. So everything that God does is based on love. Every one of His motivations is based on love. So none of us can love more than God. So don't ever think, because as human beings, sometimes we think, well, if I had all that power, if I had all that knowledge, then I would change things. I would make things better. And if we think that way, we start to lose focus on what God is doing. The disciples who spent all that time with Jesus Christ, oftentimes they would jump to conclusions or bring it down to a human level. Let's look in Luke chapter 9. So remember, I said I'm going to give you the spiritual principle. We'll look at some examples. And I don't think any of us think of God in the way of a soap opera or all that drama. So we have to look deeper. For example, vengeance. That's what we see here in Luke chapter 9. Luke chapter 9, verse 51. Now it came to pass when the time had come for him to be received up, that he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem. So it was time for Christ to go to Jerusalem. It says he set his face to go to Jerusalem. That means he's pointed in that direction. He's going to make this journey. Verse 52, and he sent messengers before his face. And as they went, they entered a village of the Samaritans to prepare for him. But they did not receive him because his face was set for the journey to Jerusalem. And so if you understand the times and what was going on here, the Samaritans did not worship in Jerusalem. And they didn't have respect for the Jews that went to Jerusalem to worship. And they knew that that's what these people were doing. So when the disciples went ahead of Christ and they were going to prepare for Christ to maybe have a meal there and sleep there and things of that nature, and they found out what they were doing, they said, no, we don't want you here, you Jews who are going up to Jerusalem, or whatever they said specifically, I don't know. But they made it clear that they didn't want them there. I was trying to remember in the car where it was that the Samaritans worshiped, and I couldn't remember. I'm convinced if I was 5 years younger, it would have come to mind, but I didn't look it up ahead of time. But maybe some of you can remember where the Samaritans worshiped. They worshiped on a mountain, but they wouldn't go up to Jerusalem. They didn't think that was the right thing to do. And so they would not receive Christ, as it says here. So notice verse 54, it says, When his disciples, James and John, saw this, they said, Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them, just as Elijah did? And so this is what popped into their mind. Now by this time, they'd seen miracles of Jesus Christ, and they whether it was good or bad zeal, they had a certain zeal for Jesus Christ. And they were upset that these people rejected him, that they wouldn't even let him sleep in their village because he was going up to Jerusalem. So what they want to do? They wanted to burn them, have fire come down from heaven and consume them. Verse 55 says, but Christ turned and rebuked them and said, you do not know what manner of spirit you are of. For the Son of Man did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. And they went to another village. And so it was a situation where they were rejected. They weren't given a place to stay or food or anything of that nature. They would say, nope, we don't want you here. Go somewhere else. Well, Jesus Christ, he just went to another village and found a place where he could go to have a meal. Whereas the disciples said, well, let's burn them. In other words, they recognized that Christ had power, and they wanted to use it against these people. But Jesus Christ didn't have that type of vengeance in his heart. Now, Christ gets angry. We have examples where Christ was angry. He was angry at sin. Christ gets angry at sin. Human beings get angry at other human beings. And we can want vengeance. So they wanted Christ to have the same attitude, to take vengeance out on these people. And that's not what he was doing at that time. So that's an example of this spiritual principle being applied. They were attributing these human characteristics of getting even or taking care of the situation to Jesus Christ. They wanted Christ to do this. Another example of the disciples is the time when Christ made the comment that it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than a rich man to enter the kingdom. I've always thought that I would like to give it a try to enter the kingdom as a rich man. but that's not my lot in life at this time, so I'll have to take Christ's word for it, that it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom. And you might remember that the disciples said, whoa, who then can enter the kingdom? Who can make it? because in their mind, anyone who had physical blessings had the love of God. God really cared for someone if they had physical things. So it didn't matter if they inherited that from their parents or grandparents or family members or how they came upon their wealth. If they had wealth, if they had physical things, they were loved by God. God had blessed them. So if we put this on a human level, if as a father you have unlimited wealth, let's say that you had invested in Facebook long before the IPO, like Bono, he was part of the venture capitalist group that invested in Facebook. So when it went through the public offering, he's now the wealthiest musician in the world because he made over $1.5 billion. So let's just say that you did that instead of Bono, and you had $1.5 billion, and your child came to you and said, "I really need a car." What would you do? Hopefully you'd buy him a car. Maybe not the nicest Ferrari, but, you know, a used Ferrari or whatever it might be. So we're talking billions here, and it's not an issue of whether or not you're able to buy them a car. So if you love them and care for them, you would take care of them. You'd make sure they have what they need, and it would probably be nice clothes and food and housing and cars and things of that nature. So in their minds, they thought, well, if I had that much to where the power just to give anything, I would give it to those whom I love. And so they were attributing the same attribute, a physical human level attribute, to God. And then they all of a sudden were stuck. Now, wait a minute. How can these people who have physical wealth not make it into the kingdom? And if they can't, what are we going to do? So that's another example. Let's look at an Old Testament example that comes up from time to time. It's why would God do this? In Genesis chapter 22, who knows what we're going to read about in Genesis 22? You know what we're going to read about? Genesis chapter 22. One of the greatest losses in this physical life that any human being can go through, I haven't had to deal with this type of grief myself, but some people have had to deal with it. It's the loss of a child, or the death of a child. And so when we have this example, and some people actually use this to show that God is a cruel God, we have this example of God telling Abraham to sacrifice his own son. And they say, how can he be a loving God? Surely he's a cruel God. And even later, God makes it very clear that he's against child sacrifice. And he condemns Israel because the people around them were worshiping in that way through child sacrifice. And Israel got caught up in it. They were doing it for a period of time, and God condemned them for it. But here, he specifically asks Abraham to do this. Let's notice in verse 1. It came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. And he said, take now your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. And so I always find this fascinating. I don't know exactly what went through Abraham's mind. But the very next verse, it doesn't say that Abraham debated it, argued with God, struggled within himself. It just says that, verse 3, Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, took two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son, and he split the wood for the burnt offering, arose and went to the place of which God had told him to. And we understand that he went to a place specifically where he was going to offer Isaac. Verse 8, it says, "And Abraham said, 'My son, God will provide for himself the lamb for burnt offering.' And the two of them went together. Then they came to the place of which God had told him, and Abraham built an altar there and placed wood in order. And he bound Isaac, his son, and laid him on the altar upon the wood." Verse 10, "And Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Eternal called to him from heaven and said, 'Abraham, Abraham.' And Abraham said, 'Here I am.' And he said, 'Do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me.'" So people wonder, how could a loving God ask anyone to do this? How could a loving God do many of the things that are dealt with in the Old Testament? We had the sermonette last week on military service. Well, when we read through the Old Testament, God commanded Israel to go to war. And war they went to, and they killed people. And sometimes they were told to kill everyone, every woman, every man, every child, every animal. That was how God dealt with them. Does it mean that God is not a loving God? God dealt with the people in the Old Testament in a very physical way, in a way that they could understand, and a way that He could work with them. He works with us in the New Testament in a very spiritual way. Hence, the emphasis on being spiritually minded and staying focused on the spiritual. So how can a loving God do this? Well, do we ever lose perspective of the fact that God views this human life so much differently than we do? Oftentimes at funerals, we talk about this very fact. It is a time to grieve. Unfortunately, God doesn't tell us to do what Ezekiel did. I can't imagine the heartache that he went through, as we heard in the opening message. Death is a time to grieve. When we lose a loved one, it's a time to grieve. But we're told not to do it the way other people do it, out of ignorance, for not knowing what's going to happen. If we keep life in perspective, that God has the perspective of this human life, then we understand that God could have easily brought back Isaac or given Abraham many sons to replace Isaac. It wasn't a hard or a difficult thing for him to do. When we think of it on a human level, we think, how could God ever ask him to do that? And yet God, his understanding, his knowledge of life, knew exactly what he was doing. So God's Holy Spirit should allow us to know God as God is God. God's Holy Spirit should allow us to know God as God is God. So understand the spiritual principle that I'm emphasizing. The spiritual principle, again, is that it's important we don't attribute human characteristics to God. Let's look at a section of scriptures that we've covered several times. I want to apply it to what I'm talking about today. In 2 Corinthians chapter 10, starting in verse 3. "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh." Verse 4, "For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God for pulling down strongholds." In verse 5, "Casting down arguments and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ." When we read through here, again, the emphasis is on being spiritually minded, not walking according to the flesh in the way that was described in Romans. But we use God's Spirit, the power of God's Spirit, for pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God. So any aspect in our relationship with our God that goes against the truth, we need to fight against it. We need to pull it down or bring it down. When it talks about the high things that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, remember the Samaritans, they worshipped on a mountain, a different one. The Jews, they went to Jerusalem, which was up on a mountain. So a high thing like this, what it's talking about is anything in our mind that replaces the true God or that we put before God. So if we're thinking physically, according to the flesh, anything that we're putting before God. So anytime we attribute a human characteristic to God, we're worshiping a false God. So it's important that we recognize when this takes place or if it's taking place in our lives. Jesus Christ said that He came to reveal the Father. Jesus Christ came to reveal the Father. And He says also that if you know Him, then we know the Father. So let me give you a challenge. Instead of going through it, I consider going through various points, but I'm just going to give you a challenge. What do you know about Jesus Christ? So if you know Christ, you know the Father. What do you know about Christ? His character, His way of life. Because if you can examine that, if we can examine that and look at it and study it, then we can know the truth about God the Father. God's Spirit should allow us to know the truth about God the Father and to have that understanding. Let's turn to Romans chapter 9. When Christ says that He came to declare the Father, that word declare, it means to reveal a mystery. So if you know Christ, you know the Father. So what do you know about Jesus Christ? Take some time, if you would, to write that out or to think about it. Romans chapter 9. Verse 14, it says, "What shall we say then? Is there unrighteousness with God? Certainly not." So if you ever think God's not treating you fairly or not dealing with you in a right way, you better examine your attitude, because there is no unrighteousness with God. For He says to Moses, "I'll have mercy on whomever I have mercy, and I will have compassion on whomever I will have compassion." So then, it is not of him who wills nor of him who runs, but of God who shows mercy. For the Scripture says to Pharaoh, "Even for this same purpose I've raised you up, that I might show my power in you, and that my name might be declared in all the earth. Therefore He has mercy on whom He wills, and whom He wills He hardens. You will say to me then, why does He still find fault? For who has resisted His will? But indeed, O man, who are you to reply against God? Will the thing formed say to him who formed it, why have you made me like this? Does not the potter have power over the clay from the same lump to make one vessel for honor and another for dishonor? What if God, wanting to show His wrath," this is verse 22, "what if God, wanting to show His wrath and to make His power known, endured with much long suffering the vessels of wrath prepared for destruction, and that He might make known the riches of His glory on the vessels of mercy, which He had prepared beforehand for glory?" So Paul is using the analogy of the potter and the clay. And we understand that it's the analogy of God and humans, human beings. So Paul is saying, can the clay ever say to the potter that I want you to make me into this? And I don't know if any of you have ever made pottery. Well, I know Brianna has. She took a class in it. Which I had to pay for. I know she's taken it. But we've, in some of our travels, we watched in various countries people making pottery that they were eager to sell to us. But never have we ever heard the clay say, make me into this. Never have we heard the clay say, I'm going to shape the potter into my form. That's not possible. That's the point that Paul's making with this analogy. And so he's bringing it down to the human level, and he's talking specifically, as we go into Pentecost, we'll talk more about this tomorrow, but some people are called today, some people are first fruits, and that's what he's getting down to here in verse 23 when he says that he might make known the riches of his glory on the vessels of mercy which he had prepared beforehand for glory. So maybe sometimes we might ask, why has God called me? Why is God working with me at this time? But it just says God has mercy on whom he'll have mercy. And so it's he's prepared this beforehand. Some people will be called at this time. Verse 24, even us whom he called, as it says, not of the Jews only, but also of the Gentiles. So at no time or in no way can the clay shape the potter in the clay's image. I think we understand it very clearly when we put it that way. The clay cannot shape the potter into the clay's image. It's the potter who shapes the clay. So anytime we start to attribute human characteristics to God, so even as we're created in God's image, and even as we can have some of the same emotions and thoughts that God may have, it's the clay shaped in the potter's image, not the other way around. But anytime we attribute human characteristics to God, it can lead to cracks in our faith. It'll lead to doubt. And it'll lead to disappointment. And yet through the power of God's Spirit, we can know the true God. We can know God the Father. The challenge is for us to see God in truth and to worship Him in spirit.